that I might begin by showing you a couple of the projects that are coming up that we've been working on, and then maybe when they come to your theater, you might go out and remember that we spent this morning together. As someone in your bulletin, I think it says that actually currently last Wednesday night and this coming Wednesday night, we've been involved in producing a documentary that's on PBS that is quite exciting, and I think maybe more than in some ways anything else we're doing illustrates the whole issue we're talking about this morning. It's a documentary that's based on a class that's actually taught at Harvard University that compares the lives and worldviews of Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. And the fact that it's being shown on PBS is something of a miracle, because the Christian worldview is so clearly presented and arguments against it are addressed, and to compare these two great thinkers of our times, one that is probably the ultimate representation of a secular worldview and the other perhaps the greatest spokesman for a Christian worldview in our time. So this has been an exciting project. We also have a number of films coming out. One that came out, if you've never seen our film Joshua, it's out on DVD and you can rent it at Blockbuster, and it was a film that I helped co-produce and write the script, and hope that it's a family film, a G-rated film the entire family can see, and with a great spiritual message. This film, I Am David, which stars Jim Caviezel, that obviously is probably best known for playing Christ in the film The Passion. Actually, when I sent the materials here to the church, was scheduled to open in October. It's actually been pushed back to December. But again, another great film with a very redemptive underlying message. Ironically, when we shot this film, we shot it before they made The Passion. And when Jim went over to the set of The Passion, they still hadn't cast most of the disciples and they hadn't cast Pilate. And Jim said, "Hey, I just finished making a film with all of these great guys, and this guy would be a great Pilate, and this guy would be a great Peter." And so our film has Jesus, Pilate, and Peter all in it. So you might want to check it out. After the first of the year, a great little film called Because of Winn-Dixie. It's based on a best-selling book that won the Newbery Prize. And the thing that's kind of neat about this film, without kind of in any way being an in-your-face sort of a thing, it has a very underlying Christian worldview. The star of the film, or the main character, is a little girl whose father is actually a pastor. A lot of the film takes place within the context of the church, but it's portrayed in a very positive kind of a way, which if you are, you know, a thinking person, you probably recognize not much in Hollywood has portrayed the community of faith in a positive way in the last few years. And it's also, by the way, for those of you that are Dave Matthews fans, it's Dave Matthews' film premiere. He has a key role in the film, and we're very excited about that. And then probably the biggest project of all, that was mentioned earlier, is that our company attained from the C.S. Lewis estate the film rights to the Chronicles of Narnia, and the first of those is in production. I just got back from New Zealand and got to see some of the early footage. It's being directed by Andrew Adamson, that directed Shrek and Shrek 2, and it's live action on the scale and at the budget of The Lord of the Rings, and so we're very excited to be able to bring C.S. Lewis to the world, and that film will be distributed by Disney and will be their big Christmas film 2005. So lots of things going on, and again, just wanted to give you a little bit of a look at what we're doing. The reason we're doing it has everything to do with this passage of Scripture that kind of sits behind everything you've seen this morning in terms of light and darkness, and didn't really get into the salt dimension. But this is a passage that Jesus spoke in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm not really going to read the whole passage to you, and I'd encourage you to go back and look it up in the Gospel of Matthew. But this is really where, in a sense, Christ gives he gives us a sense of identity, and he gives us a sense of purpose as to what those of us that attempt to follow him are intended to be in the world in which we live. And so he says to the disciples, "You are the salt of the earth." And salt in those days was not only a flavoring, it was the primary preservative. And without salt, food became corrupted in that culture. And so he was saying to them, part of your role is to penetrate the culture, to give it flavor, and also to give it preservative against corruption. And then he went on and said, "You're the light of the world." And, of course, light, you know, being this great image of truth and beauty and goodness and all that's positive that comes to invade the darkness, much like Christ had come, because, of course, He was the light of the world. And now He says to you and I, we're the light of the world. And what I'd like to do this morning, instead of teaching on this passage, which I've done many times in the past, is, in a sense, I'm going to take one particular area of our culture, and I want to look at it from this perspective of how the followers of Christ became salt and then lost their saltiness, and something of the impact that that has had on the culture and society in which we live, and then give you a few ideas, not only in terms of the industry that I happen to work in, but perhaps some ideas as how we can once again be the kind of an influence in contemporary culture that Christ obviously intended us to be. Back in 1966, Andy Warhol made the following statement. He said, "It's the movies that have really been running things in America ever since they were invented. They show you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, how to feel about it, and how to look when you do it." Now, it's fascinating that that statement would have been made in 1966. It's an interesting date. It'll come up a little bit later on in my comments. But the thing that's fascinating to me about it is that that was true in 1966, more so probably true today. And yet in 1966, film as an industry was only a little more than half a century old. How did this technology and this phenomena in a little over 50 years basically capture popular culture? Well, let me give you a real brief little look at how that happened. Film really is a phenomena of our century. The first decade of film, which really began around the turn of the century, film originally was an entertainment form for the lower classes that couldn't afford to go to the theater. And if you wanted to see a little bit of film, you went to a penny arcade and you watched it through what was called a peep show. And most of those little films were extremely short. The first, what's called major motion picture, was made in 1903 in New Jersey. It was called The Great Train Robbery, and it was 12 minutes long. Now, what happened is that as we moved into the next decade of film history, film began to be a much broader phenomena. As a matter of fact, instead of going to a penny arcade and watching it in a little box, early into that first decade of the new century, technology was invented which could now project those moving pictures onto screens, and people began to come, and the very first theater that was specifically designed only to show motion pictures opened in 1902 in Los Angeles. And yet within 3 years, there were 10,000 Nickelodeons stretching across the United States. And film began to have a much broader impact than it did when it simply was an entertainment for the lower classes. By the time we get into the 20s, film really began to conquer the middle class in America. And at the same time it began to conquer the middle class, it also began to experience an extreme decline in the morality of what was being shown and made in films of that area, that era. And amazingly, by the end of the 20s, the film industry was the fourth largest industry in America. Well, it was about at this point in time when film began to be such a tremendous influence on culture, and where the moral state of film was deteriorating, that really believers in Christ recognized we need to do something in this area. And so in the 30s, Jesus came to Hollywood. And this is how it happened. First of all, the Catholic Church developed an entity within the church called the Legion of Decency. And at the same time, the Protestant Church set up an office in Hollywood called the Protestant Film Commission. And those two entities, representing sort of followers of Christ, salt and light in the world, had a tremendous influence in what happened in the next 30 years in the film industry. The biggest thing that happened was that working together with the studios, they developed what was called the production code. Now, if you talk to people in Hollywood today about the production code, they act as if it was some period of horrendous repression where artistic freedom was quashed. And yet the reality is that this was a code that the studios and the Catholic Church and the Protestant Film Commission worked together to decide what was proper to show in films because of the tremendous influence that films had in America. And the studios welcomed it because the studios wanted the audience that the Protestant Film Commission and the Legion of Decency represented. And out of that period of time, some of the greatest films that were ever made were made. Studios welcomed it, scripts were read and approved, and these are some of the films that were made during that period of the production code. Whoa, am I losing this? I'm sorry, did I lose my mic? Here. Thank you. And those that are in parentheses are the films that happened to win the Academy Award during that year. Now, when you look at these great films and you look at the kind of influence that was happening within the community of faith, I think you've got to ask a big question. And the question obviously is, what happened? And in the terms of the theme of what we're talking about this morning, I would say that what happened was the salt lost its saltiness. The 60s happened, for one thing, and somehow the phenomena of the 60s kind of convinced the church that perhaps Hollywood was not a place where it should be. And so first the Legion of Decency kind of dissipated in terms of its influence and what it was doing. And in 1966, interestingly, the same year that Andy Warhol made that observation, the Protestant Film Commission shut down. And suddenly, the church had left Hollywood. And someone observed that when that happened, that Hollywood plummeted into the moral abyss. The first thing that happened was that the production code was dropped. And instead of the production code, which again was this this product of, you know, believers working together with studios trying to say films should represent something of the moral values of the culture as a whole, what happened was that the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, developed the rating system, which we use to this day. What most people don't understand about the rating system is that the rating system is controlled by a 7-member board. Each of those members picked from one of the 7 major studios. And so suddenly, Hollywood began policing itself. And out of that, the impact of that was tremendous. For one thing, after 1966, you see a tremendous increase in violence in films. You see a tremendous increase in the place of sexuality in films. If we can go back, it would be great. An increase in crude language and behavior, an anti-religious bias, and interestingly, a plummeting box office. I simply picked this picture of the poster from the film Clockwork Orange. It actually didn't appear until 1971, but what fascinated me when I went back and looked at the poster advertising this film, you can't really quite see it, but at the top of the film it has what's called the tagline. This is, you know, kind of that line that advertisers come up with to sort of capture your imagination to get you to come to a movie. And Clockwork Orange, the tagline was being the adventures of a young man whose principal activities are rape, ultraviolence, and Beethoven. This was a film, I would suggest to you, that never could have been made under the old production code and yet began to represent the kind of films that were made from 1966 forward. Now, I want to fast forward for a little bit because I want to bring you to today and talk a little bit about the impact of film today and then go back and look at a little bit of what possibly can be done. We're told today that, popular culture and film probably has the greatest influence on the lives of our children than anything else in America today. For instance, if you're here this morning and let's say, like I do, you have a teenager, and you are committed to being a part of this great
ministry and to coming here. And let's say that your teen actually would begin coming to church from the time they were born till the time they were 17. They never missed a week. And every week they were exposed to 1 hour of solid spiritual input, of which they were totally focused in on and not missing a word of what was being said. All right. Much like my son, you know, when he goes to church, I've watched. The result is that by the time that they were 17 years of age, they will have experienced 800 hours of spiritual input in their life. During that same 17 years, they will be exposed to 40,000 hours of visual media in our culture. That's the significance of how much media, film, television plays in the lives of our culture. During that 40,000 hours, they will witness 50,000 murders committed. They will see 100,000 beers consumed. And they will be exposed to innumerable situations of sexual encounters. Now, today, we're told that the average teen goes to the movie 50 times a year. The same average teen rents 50 movies a year. 90% of teens, when questioned, said that their favorite leisure activity is going to the movies. And even if you happen to be a part of a faith community, 92% of Christian kids watch exactly the same films that their non-Christian counterparts watch. Now, not to let adults up, because I think adults, our great problem is the television. We're told today that the average adult in America, and this is incomprehensible, really, watches 6 to 7 hours of television a day. In Denver, one of the major electrical companies actually was running an ad saying the average adult watches 7 hours of television a day. And then they show a big screen TV and it said, let's get it up to 8. You know, so what that means is that if you were the average person, adult in America today, that you will spend literally 15 years of your life in front of a television set. This picture here shows a young family, and I had a different illustration, and it didn't work too well, so the guys popped this in. But what you see here is, you know, a husband and a wife and a family, you know, all sitting glued onto the TV set. Now, you go fast forward a couple of years, and it looks a little bit more like this. There is no husband, wife. The one that I had a guy just like slamming food down his face while he was watching the television set, and the family's gone. And, you know, it's taking its toll in America today. Now, not only are you and I and our children consuming incredible quantities of media, but part of what we all need to understand is something of the quality of that experience and what happens when a person goes to see a film. Just think about this for a minute. First of all, you enter a semi-dark room, and in most cases you sit in a comfortable seat. Like this auditorium this morning, of course, most theaters have now gone to stadium seating where you have an absolutely unobstructed view. By the way, I speak at many churches all across America once, and most churches, you know, are you can't even see what's going on up front because your view is obstructed. But when you're in a movie theater, it's much like you are this morning, where you have this unobstructed view. You're extremely comfortable. The lights go down low. The music comes up with these phenomenal, you know, digital theater system, audio systems. Images are projected with perfect clarity, and stories are told that capture the viewer's complete attention. You watch the difference sometime, look around in a church service at, you know, teenage kids, actually most adults. I really like this setup, by the way, because I can't see any of you. And it's good because most places I look out and I see how many people are drifting off to sleep. And I, you know, you could be dead asleep and I wouldn't know this morning. So if you're tired, go ahead. But anyway, And then watch the face of a child or a teen or even an adult in a movie theater. And for 90 minutes to 120 minutes to however long that film is, most of us are held totally captive to that story being told. And a very unique phenomena happens in film, which is the phenomena of suspended disbelief. You go into a film auditorium and in a sense, you put aside many of your filters and simply sit and absorb what's being told. That phenomena is so powerful that as early as the 1920s, Vladimir Lenin made the statement that film is the most powerful tool for shaping the human mind ever invented. And by the way, his successor, Joseph Stalin, went on to build state-of-the-art film studios in every one of the states of the Soviet Union, which today Hollywood is using to, you know, lower their budgets. And so when you hear a film being shot in Czechoslovakia or in Poland or someplace like that, they're actually being shot in studios that were built by the communists to create communist propaganda because they understood the power of this medium. David Putnam, who was a great producer and probably maybe best known for being the producer of Chariots of Fire, made the statement that every film has within it an element of propaganda. When I speak to high school kids, this is one of the things that I try and communicate, because most of us, and you know, adults probably no different than high school kids, but high school kids particularly, don't understand there is a message to every movie. It doesn't make any difference if it's a stupid comedy like, you know, Dodgeball or American Pie or whatever, but those films always come out of some kind of a value system and are always communicating some kind of a message. And basically, it's you know, whether it's intentional or unintentional, it's like being exposed to the greatest source of propaganda in the world. I recently read an article that talked about this, and in the article, you can agree with it or not agree with it, but this particular article said, here's the propaganda that most films in Hollywood are feeding us. Number one, God does not exist. Number two, the God who exists is not personal. Three, God's irrelevant. Romantic love, sex, money, and power are the highest goals of life. Premarital and extramarital sex is normal, frequent, and okay, and is without consequences. Rebellion and disrespect is normal, frequent, and okay. Crude language and behavior is normal, frequent, and okay. Smoking, drinking, and recreational drug use is normal, frequent, and okay. Romantic love is real love. Hollywood stars are to be imitated and idolized. If you could only meet some of these people. I won't go on there. Hollywood stars and rock musicians have the answers. Christians are kooks. Conservatives are kooks. If you haven't seen Fahrenheit 9/11, this is the way that conservatives, Christians, and I don't care what your political convictions are. I'm just saying this is what's being communicated. Youth, beauty, and money determine the value of life. And that message is constantly being bombarded through film and media. And the result is that it impacts what we think. It impacts what we do. It impacts what we feel so potently that it's been said that in our times, the movie theater is the church of the postmodern world. Well, it's quite a dilemma. And, you know, I think given the limited time we have this morning, let me turn to sort of the next obvious question, which is, what can be done? I mean, if we are supposed to be salt and light and influence our culture, what can be done? How do we get the light out of the closet? How do we get the salt out of the shaker? And I'm going to make some suggestions. And again, reflecting on this, you know, I'm generally dealing with the film industry, but I really think that that some of these suggestions transcend that and really speak to how we influence culture in numerous kinds of ways. I hope that some of this will transfer over. How can I make a difference? Well, first of all, let me tell you how not to make an influence. And this is what has not worked historically. Number one, isolation. As a matter of fact, the whole idea of boycotting, I actually think boycotts could work. I think that if every person of faith in America, 135 million people attend religious services every Sunday morning, I think if all of us just decided that we weren't going to go to certain kinds of movies and we were going to go to other kinds of movies, that you would see the film industry change. Fortunately, there is some of that going on simply because of the influence of the passion in many ways. But generally speaking, isolation doesn't work. As a matter of fact, when the church boycotts a film, or some group boycotts a film, normally what happens is that it's free publicity for the film and it increases attendance. I was recently told a fascinating thing, and that was that when the movie Saved came out, if you didn't see this, it's sort of a film that, you know, generally mocks a Christian high school and makes, you know, kids that are, you know, serious Christians look like hypocrites. And of course, the good guy in the film is the guy that doesn't believe, and, you know, the unbelieving Jewish student and someone else are the kind of the heroes of the film. Well, I was told that the studio that produced that actually sent clips of that movie out to pastors around the country, hoping that they would get so irate that they would launch boycotts. Because boycotts are great advertising for a film. It just hasn't worked. Isolation. I think a second strategy that doesn't work is what I'd call internalization, which is just to do nothing. You know, this is sort of the frog in the kettle dilemma. And that is that we become so, integrated into culture as a whole, and we allow the values of culture to so become internalized in our lives that we just simply do nothing. And we've seen how that has worked over the last 40 years. The third is what I'm simply calling intimidation. And, you know, I know this is probably not true of you guys, because I can tell you're a great group. You got a great spirit. But generally speaking, what people of faith have been great at in addressing our culture is cursing the darkness. We are great at pointing out the problem. We're just not great about bringing light into the darkness. And basically, these haven't worked. Well, what are some influencing possibilities? You know, how can you and I make a difference? And these are just some ideas. You probably would have more. But these kind of came to my mind as I was, you know, thinking about this issue. First of all, the first possibility is to intercede. And I don't say that lightly. I really think that this is an issue that we really need to pray about and pray for what's happening in popular culture today. And obviously, that's something all of us can do. I can tell you this. When you make a film that has a spiritual dimension to it, that's a positive spiritual dimension, and particularly if it has any elements of a Christian worldview, you encounter tremendous difficulties. Because I think you're in enemy territory. And people, and there are many of them, trying to make a difference, need people to pray for them. So pray. Pray for Hollywood. Pray for people that are working in the film industry, and all of us can do that. Secondly, stay informed. Again, I think this is a huge issue because most of us are not very discriminating consumers. And I think it's important to kind of stay informed what's happening in the film industry. What are the messages being shown? Helping our kids, you know how to be intelligent consumers of media. And most of us, I think, unless you just, you know, never are ever going to go to a film again and really don't care. But if you care about culture, staying informed, I think, is important. Others, I think, some called to investigate. It's very interesting to go to websites like, you know, unplugged.com, which is a Focus on the Family website, where really some pretty sharp people take a look at popular culture and critique it and investigate it. Media Guide, which is a a website again and a publication put out by Ted Baer, takes every film that comes out of Hollywood and analyzes it in by 235 different criteria to try and assess and help people understand what's the worldview, what's being said here, you know, what are the good things, what are the bad things. So some are called to that. One of the big ones is to invite. I think that when films come out that have a redemptive message and films come out that particularly are trying to do something in this area that are good, you know, that one of the great things that we can do is simply not only support them ourselves, but to invite friends and utilize film as a tool because it engages conversation. Again, I really encourage you, if you didn't see the first half, look at the second half of the Freud and Lewis debate on Wednesday night. And part of that is a debate, along with the content of simply the program itself, is a debate among seven people representing seven very different worldviews. And film becomes a means of discussion, opening the conversation at least, and you supporting the good and perhaps inviting others to experience it makes a difference. I think the other strategy is to invest. And I know that it takes a lot of money to get involved in this area. And frankly, I'm not here to pitch you on that because I happen to work for a company that doesn't need money. But I do think that part of the reason that the films that are made is because people back them financially, invest in them financially, and people of faith just have not done that historically. For some of you, there could be a call on your life to be involved and to utilize the resources that God's given you or to create groups of people. The church in America this year will spend $100 billion on its mission. That's what the budget of the church with a capital C is. The film industry will spend $10 billion. And so far, the film industry has a much greater influence at one-tenth of the expense on popular culture than the church is having. So I think this is an area that some people need to seriously think about. And then finally, for some of you, invade. And that is a small band of men and women that God actually calls into this terrain as their ministry and their mission. And I'm encouraged. When I first started going to Los Angeles several years ago, you know, I didn't know if there was another person in the entire town that was there because they had a sense that God had put them there. And virtually every trip I took out, I had some kind of a divine encounter where I met someone that was there because they knew that God had called them there. You know, some of our young men and women, you know, I'm excited that that in the future, you know, people that have been exposed to, you know, the truth and have grown up in situations where they have learned to love God, you know, might be in that arena trying to make a difference. Well, finally, I need to close. Let me make just one final statement, because I think when you think about the state of the world today and you think about perhaps the state of popular culture and you think about changing it, sometimes doesn't it just seem impossible? I know that I've had times in my life where I just felt like, you know, we're just going to try and do the right thing until Christ comes again, but we're not really going to change anything because it's too overwhelming. I don't believe that anymore. I actually believe that we can change the world. And my feelings about that came from a very unlikely source. We're doing a film based on one of Clive Cussler's novels, trying to make sort of an Indiana Jonesy family-friendly series of films. And I'd never read one of Clive Cussler's novels, and I'm actually not recommending that you read any of Clive Cussler's novels this morning. But I read this novel called Atlantis Found, and it taught me an important lesson. If you haven't read the novel, the plot line is pretty simple, and that is that down in South America, there are still this group of kind of descendants of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis that are still trying to figure out how to take over the world. And instead of having a war, they've come up with a very innovative idea. They've gone down to Antarctica, and they have begun to build a tunnel across the Ross Ice Shelf, which is a massive ice shelf that doesn't sit on top of hard land. Much of Antarctica, you know, the ice is over land, but there's this massive ice shelf. And in the book, these guys have figured out if we can break off the Ross ice shelf, the impact of that would basically be the same as what some scientists believe happened 65 million years ago when a meteor hit the Earth, that the impact of that is that it will literally shift the Earth's axis enough that the entire world will be covered by the seas, that the dry land will become oceans again, and oceans will become dry land, and basically everybody that's not part of this group, which have built these like boats the size of cities to, you know, weather the storm, will be destroyed and they'll take over the world. Well, it's kind of a goofy story, I know. But the thing I began to think about is, if you're like me, I usually think changing the world means I've got to turn it 180 degrees upside down, and I know I'm not going to do that. But the reality is that there's a cultural axis that determines light and darkness, salt and decay in our world. And all we really need to do is to influence the culture enough, just to that degree where we can make enough of a change that we can simply shift that cultural axis even one degree, and everything will change. And if you and I take seriously this calling that Christ has given us, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world, and together we seek to make some impact on the world in which we live. We can change everything. Thank you.
Of all the world, high on the hill, so You are the salt of all the earth. You are His feet, His eyes and head. You are the light of all the world.
Thanks for being here today. We talked a little bit about being light. You know, churches shouldn't be this much fun. I mean, it just continues. We just have a great time. Next week, we were talking about how to have a tighter family, taking your family to the next level. If you want to kind of find a way to maybe take your family to the next level, you're going to enjoy. We got some really fun, kind of crazy stuff planned next week. Thank you for being here. Hope you enjoyed the Lumiere and the little candles and lights we had today. Thank you, and we will see you next week. Thanks for being here.